Okay. Hi. Questions? Announcements. I am now synchronized with that clock, so it was right, I was wrong. Rarely happens, but every once in a while. We will get this child born today, I promise. And just a reminder, I've had actually first a question. Has anybody tried to download the audio recordings to save them on your computer to play them later? Yes? Did it? You did it. Okay, it can be done. Anybody try and fail other than the one person who's already asked me? I'm sorry? Yeah, you can listen to it, but apparently at least one person is having difficulty being able to download it to save to play later. And theoretically you can do that, so I was just wondering if it's possible to do it, and it is, therefore we know we have a problem someplace else. It's not with the originator. Good. Other questions that have been coming up. How the heck do you make sense out of page after page after page after page of material in the textbook, and what do you really need to know? Those are good questions. I like that. Okay, now, moving on. Those are good questions, and yes, you should learn everything. No, you can't learn everything, and you shouldn't feel guilty about that. But you should have general outlines. You should have the major points in mind, the ones that are described at the end of each chapter. Those summaries are good. You should have underlined in your text or highlighted, forget the resale value. It's yours now, and you need to use it. Use it. Textbooks are to use, not to put under your pillow and hope something osmosis through into your brain. Use it. Mark it up. Ask questions in the margin. Put nice big stars or whatever you like, exclamation points in the margins. That's why they're wide and blank. Wherever there's a connection between what the text says and something I have emphasized, where you see an illustration or an example of something, mark that in the margin, so when you go back to review the text, which you will if you're using it, you will review it, and then you'll review it again, and then you'll go back and look at the highlights the day before the exam. That's how you use a text. You don't just read it once and hope something sticks. You're actually trying to understand how the material is organized, what the content is, how my lectures might illustrate parts of it, and use the combination of the lectures and the text to try to develop your matrix and your understanding of how development happens for a person from conception to recycling. Okay. That won't happen by reading the text once. It will only happen as you try to answer study questions, as you try to answer your own questions, as you get together with a study group, two or three other people who are interested in sitting down and going over notes with you and looking at the text together and arguing about what you think is really important and what it means. That's how you study to try to understand material. You practice saying your understanding of it in words, because that's what you're going to have to do on the essays, on the exam. You need to hear the language. You need to practice saying it, hoping that something sticks, and then pulling it out and trying to write it so that it makes sense for the very first time in the middle of an exam is not efficient, and it won't work. So work on it. Study it. Argue about it. Talk about it. Put it on your blog. Email your parents. get your mother's opinion about conception and your father's opinion and, you know, all those other things that you can get. How many of you have so far created a study group? Whether you've met or not, you at least know you have one. Okay. The advice I put in the syllabus is all tested. It is all valid. It works. People who are in study groups do better in this course than people who are not. Yeah. So, review the syllabus. Do the study skills workshops through the Learning Co-op. Do the exam taking workshops through the Learning Co-op. The URL, the website, is on the syllabus. So do those. Because I'm going to make you feel embarrassed if you come after the first exam and say, how could I have done better on this? And I go through the list and you haven't done any of them. And I'm going to say, why not? Study group? Study skills workshops? Exam taking workshops? Come to talk to Talia during her office hours? Come to the review sessions when we schedule them? All of them. You don't need this, do you? Okay. Some of you need this, all right. If you need for me to harangue you and tell you how to survive, make an appointment and I'll be happy to do that. We should make a video. Remind me, make a videotape of Larry's harangue about study skills. But the question keeps coming up, you know, how can I do well in this course? And all of those suggestions are valid and they all work. But only if you do them, you know. So, yeah, you can't learn all the detail in the text. There's no point doing that. But do learn the stuff that's interesting to you. Do try to explain the stuff that seems like it would illustrate important points from lecture. Or try to learn and use the material that's related to study questions in the syllabus. Okay. And if you do that in each of your courses, okay, and keep up with all the reading, you won't have time to sleep, eat, or have a life. That's welcome to college. So. Is that enough? That's enough. All right. Do you want to say anything more about how they can enlist your help in forming a study group, Talia?
I'm going to put a piece of paper down at the bottom on the table and form that to put your name and the other side's query, put your email address, and you can also come to my office hours. If more than one person comes to my office hours, by the time we can start to discuss it, we'll group together and meet on your own. Then if you need somebody to bounce questions off of,
Yeah, it is. I'd forgotten what day, but I think we have two more weeks. The 2nd of October. Tutors are available for this course, too, through the Tutoring Center and the Learning Co-op, if you know you're going to need help. Okay. All right. Questions. This is one of the overheads that I had on Monday. And if you recall, the point was that major abnormalities happen at the time when something is first differentiating. So when it's first beginning to be formed and getting organized as a part or as an organ, then that's when it's most susceptible to influence, particularly to damage. And after it gets formed, it still may be vulnerable, but not nearly as vulnerable as it was when it was first differentiating. So there may be some minor defect or a deviation in size, but once something is already formed and its basic structure is present, then it's not likely to be severely defective due to an outside influence. Just a reminder, and I remember that I suggested that you might try drawing the various parts, the uterus surrounding the whole pregnancy, the uterine lining, that part that you grow and shed every month until you get pregnant, in which case you don't shed it, the placenta, which is actually much more closely bound to the lining than this suggests, the umbilical cord arising from the placenta going into the abdomen of the fetus, the chorion is the gray area, that's the primary membrane around the pregnancy that is part of the pregnancy, and the placenta is part of the chorion. It's a projection of that large membrane that surrounds the whole thing. Inside the chorion, there's another membrane called the amnion, the orange one, and that's filled with fluid and fetus. And this pregnancy is fairly far along given the maturity of the fetus, but it's probably in the middle because there's still a good deal of space, fluid-filled space, for the fetus. And eventually, it's going to be born through the cervix, unless it's a cesarean section. Okay. One of you asked what a placenta really looks like. And this illustration probably doesn't show up as well as I might like. Let me turn the brightness down. Maybe we'll... Okay. Anyway, this is the chorionic sac. So this would be as if you removed the entire pregnancy from the uterus. And this is the placenta. So you can see that it's very convoluted. Those are the villi, which project into similar villi in the lining of the uterus. But this has been removed from the lining of the uterus so that you can see it. And then this is that large, strong outer membrane, the rest of the chorion. And then inside that would be the amnion, the inner membrane, the fluid, and the fetus with the umbilical cord. And this one is described as a 13-week pregnancy. So this is 3 months in, a third of the way through, and you can see how well-developed and significant in size the placenta is. That is the amniotic fluid, and it means that the chorion and the amnion, both of those membranes, have been ruptured. And that happens as contractions begin to get strong, all the analogies are a little weak, but it's as if you were squeezing a water balloon in such a way that it could not squish in any direction but one. And normally when you squeeze a water balloon, it tries to go in every other direction but where your hands are. But a contraction is a contraction of the entire uterus So it's squeezing the entire chorion, the entire pregnancy, all at once. So there's no place for it to go, except toward the weak spot, which is the cervix. So at that point, with the increased pressure, those two membranes will rupture, and the pressure of the contraction will force the fluid out through that rupture and through the cervix. Okay, we're going to hold off a little bit on birth. We will get there today. But I wanted to go back to the outline of the course of prenatal development and talk about just a couple of other features here. And one of those, I mean, you can go down through it, and again, I'm not interested in you knowing what day a particular organ forms or is completed, but I do want you to know that they are formed and that they are completed and that they are begun during the embryonic period. So in the first third of pregnancy or less, all of your organs, all of your parts are begun. They then continue to grow, many of them through the rest of pregnancy and some of them beyond. Your brain is still developing for most of you. If you're over 23 or 24, that may not be happening anymore, sorry, but you're already as fully developed as you possibly need to be at that point, brain-wise. But I wanted to point out at 38 days, the upper lip and palate are forming, and that illustrates an important point of how this little embryo is developing. You all know what your palette is, I assume. If you're a painter, it's what the board that you put your paint on, right? But if you're a human and most other mammals, the palate is a hard surface at the top of your mouth. It's a hard surface at the top of your mouth. That's called your hard palate. You have a soft palate too, which is farther back, and is a continuation of that palate, but it turns into soft tissue. And when you gag or when you have strep throat, you're often aware of your soft palate in a way that you're not normally, unless you're going along saying lots of sounds which involve your soft palate and engaging it. What's the importance of the palate forming and the upper lip? But it's important for many reasons, but the reason it comes to our attention is that often children are born with an incomplete upper lip and or an incomplete palate. So it's not fully formed, and that's a problem, particularly in staying alive and eating and breathing. So here's what happens. The early embryo is essentially becoming a tube. And the tube, as it forms, is going to have a face end and an ass end, a rectal end, anal end, the other end. And as what's going to happen then is that this creature, this tube, is going to surround things. And it's going to surround food and drink. You know, lots of us do that a lot, and we enjoy that. And that food and drink goes in the top end, the face, and eventually gets processed down through the tube, through the various organs, all of which are connected to each other, to continue to create a continuous gastrointestinal tract that comes out the other end. Or we surround what we breathe, the air, ideally. Don't breathe the water, it's not good for you. We take in the air and it goes only part way, and it goes to the lungs and gets caught there, and the oxygen gets removed from it, and the waste gases, things we don't need, get put in it, and we breathe it out again after having changed it in our lungs. So these are two very important processes, and interestingly, we're designed so that the lungs and the esophagus both emerge at the front end. right next to each other. And in fact, the tubes open into the same cavity at the face end. And at the beginning of the development of the GI tract and the respiratory tract, that cavity is just a cavity. It's like, any of you watch Star Trek, the old Star Trek, the original Star Trek? Wonderful scene where there's some gigantic organism that is swallowing up spaceships. I've forgotten what they called it. But anyway, it's a long tube, and it's got this great opening into which the Enterprise carefully inserts itself in order to rescue something. I've forgotten the details. But it's a wonderful thing with this open end, and that's what the embryo looks like. It's got a head, a brain, the beginning of a skull up there, and then it's got this opening. And what's going to happen is that the tube is going to grow around the opening. So this flesh that will become your face starts off on the sides of this cavity and grows around the opening. Not completely around, because it has to have openings. And those openings are your nostrils and your mouth. Those are really important openings. So as it grows in from the side and joins. It comes from the two separate sides, and it joins in the middle. And you can see that if you look in the mirror or turn to your neighbor and open your mouth wide, and you look up there and you've got a seam. You've got a seam in your upper lip, and you've got a seam down your palate, and you've got a seam down the middle of your tongue and under your tongue and all the way back up, and you pull your lower lip down, it continues. So you can see where the two sides came together and fused. They grew from the side and they fused, and that's an important process. When the upper lip is starting to form, what that means is that this opening, which is both your nose and your mouth, is beginning to be divided as your lip grows in from the side to meet, you know, under the mustache, it meets and forms an upper lip. And eventually it'll form an upper jaw where your teeth will have their roots. And ideally, you want that to form all the way and look normal. If it doesn't, you have an unfinished lip, which we used to call a hare lip. We don't call it hare lip anymore. But it was called that because hares, they're like rabbits, but they're different, have an upper lip that looks like that. If you've ever tried to kiss a rabbit, you discover that there's not much upper lip action there because they don't have it. Anyway, so the lip is growing in, and that's beginning at day 38. At day 40, the palate is beginning to grow on the inside, and it's coming in from the sides, and it's coming over what will be your mouth, your oral cavity, and it's coming under what will be your nasal cavity. And its purpose is to divide the oral cavity from the nasal cavity. This is really important because behind the palate, the oral cavity and the nasal cavity, the GI tract and the respiratory tract actually share space. And this is not good because you need to be able to separate them at times. You need to be able to separate them when you're a newborn because you need to suck. And if you've ever put a straw or a nipple in your mouth and tried to suck, I recommend that you do this so you get an appreciation for what newborns are like. Just get a nipple, bottle nipple, put it in your mouth. See how long it takes you to figure out how to get milk out of that thing. The problem is that you need to be able to exert pressure. You need to be able to create a partial vacuum. And if you put that nipple, you can do that. But if you close your mouth around the nipple, you can't do it while you talk, but if you close your mouth around the nipple, you will discover that you can still breathe. This is because you have a palate, which is sealing off the oral cavity and separating it from the nasal cavity. That's really important because otherwise, if you were a baby trying to suck, you would not be able to breathe. coordinating sucking and breathing is a very important thing for babies to be able to do, and it requires a complete palate. If you don't have a complete palate, you can create the suction. The milk will go up into your nasal cavity and down the back, and you will gag. And you will choke. And you will eventually, if you keep trying to do this, be extremely frustrated as a newborn. Your parent will be extremely frustrated because she can't feed you. And eventually you will get enough milk down in your lungs that you will develop infections and you will die. Which used to be what happened to kids who had incomplete palates. In 1908, it happened to my uncle. My brother was one of four, but one of them didn't survive the newborn period because he had a cleft lip and palate. That's recorded on his death certificate, which I just found out last month. I didn't know why he died. It just, you know, one of those things you never would find. But my cousin actually found the birth certificate, which said cleft palate. And with a cleft palate, he was unable to eat. And in the process of doing that, he probably got a lot of milk in his lungs and either drowned or developed infections or both. Or starved to death, whatever. But it's not a fun way to do it. Since 1908, and I don't know when, the medical profession has made it possible to partially to cover over the opening. So you do skin grafts, you can put a prosthesis in there, and then change it as the kid grows. But what happens later on the outline, you'll see that the palate is complete, and that is at day 56, 8 weeks. Lip and palate are united. That means that they've come together, the palate is fully formed, and from that point on, the baby is fairly safe to be born 7 months later and be able to both eat and breathe at the same time. Why does it not go all the way? For a number of reasons, but one of the best documented is malnutrition during that period of time. Another is stress. Women who experience very severe stresses during the period when the palate is forming often have, more often than otherwise, have babies who have incomplete palates and lips. During the Nazi bombing of London, for example, the number of cleft palate babies went way up because of the stress of nightly bombing during World War II. In Holland, there was a spike during a period when the Nazis had taken over Holland and people were hiding. Malnutrition was very common, and babies during that period, fetuses either didn't survive, or embryos either didn't survive or had cleft palate or other defects related to malnutrition. But the process is very simple. It's growing, and then for some reason it stops before it's complete. And the degree of incompleteness can be very, very minor, so you don't even notice it except that maybe there's a gap between the front teeth that's bigger than normal and the upper jaw didn't unite. Sometimes it's very minor, and we discover later, this is a relatively new discovery, that often the incompleteness is only in the soft palate in the back. And it leads to some pronunciations, some elocution problems, that people can't form certain words or say certain combinations of letters as they ought to because the soft palate is doing too much when it shouldn't do that much. And it does that because it's forked. It didn't completely form. Okay. Questions about that? Yeah.
The first few days, if a child is born, how do they feed it intravenously?
How do you feed a baby who is born with a cleft palate before you can do surgical intervention? Tube feeding. You put a tube down its throat. And that's actually a fairly old process, but eventually the kid has to be able to eat on his own. But You can use a gastric tube and put the food past the palate directly into the stomach, and that's how lots of us get fed, and that works for newborns as well. It's even sometimes done for supplemental feeding if the child needs extra nutrition or particular supplements. Is it possible for them to continue growing too far so that they overlap? Yes, and most of the processes can continue too long. What that really means, it's called hyperplasia, and it means that they've grown, they keep growing. Overlapping would not be the problem for the palate or the lip as much as bulging. So they would continue to grow, but instead of growing together so that you form a single plate, it would grow and then it would keep growing because it would be continuing to be pushed out. So there are birth defects that are based on things not stopping when they should and growing too far, and then the specific shape of that tissue will depend on where the growth centers are and what the possibilities are for that to happen. Hyperplasia can happen later in life too. The condition of hyperplasia of breast tissue, that this breast tissue begins to develop at puberty and doesn't stop as it normally does, and some women have continued breast growth sometimes until menopause. It could be for almost any part of the body. You could have too much tissue, and the uvula in the down here could be too large, and that could be a problem. Yeah. Yes. Orange. Have.
Lisps.
I'm sorry. Lisps. I couldn't understand. I'm sorry. I'm not making fun of lisps. Lisps. It went away. Probably at puberty. A split palate, soft palate, would not normally be involved in a lisp because a lisp is a sound that's made in the front of the mouth with interference with the tongue and the teeth. Having a large tongue could give you a lisp, and tongues can be too large for the space available. Some people have normal-sized tongues and very small oral cavities, just genetic chance, and sometimes when speech is a severe problem, the size of the tongue can actually be reduced. That problem of having an overlarge tongue is also common in Down syndrome. One of the difficulties that Down syndrome, people with Down syndrome have is in speaking, and particularly in learning to speak as young children, is that the tongue is large for the oral cavity, and motor control is difficult for Down syndrome kids, all kinds of motor control. And the tongue is in need of being controlled. It's a motor skill to control it.
So if people survive childhood, they don't have motor skills or anything like that, is there any possibility of the palate or the continuing
to
form throughout their lifetime?
No. Normally, when things are supposed to stop, particularly the things like the palate, fingers, all kinds of parts of the body have a time when growth is happening and then it stops, often until puberty when it may increase in size again or change function when different genes are turned on. normally you would not expect growth to happen if it's not a normal thing for it to continue growing. There are a couple of exceptions to that, but they're in very limited parts of the body. My first father-in-law, when I met him, I was rather surprised, because when he shook hands, it was kind of like grabbing a catcher's mitt, and he looked like a fighter. He was ugly, really ugly. And his jaw was much larger than it should be, and his lower teeth stuck way out beyond his upper teeth. And that development had happened in his 30s. He developed a condition in which his pituitary began to function abnormally. The pituitary creates growth hormone, and he secreted increased amounts of growth hormone in his 30s for a period of time, during which the parts of the body which are still open to influence by growth hormone grew, and that includes his feet, his hands, some bones in the shoulders, shoulder blade particularly, and the lower jaw. And people who have this condition, when it's not caught and treatable, and in his 30s it wasn't treatable,
your big hands.
Before that, he'd been the handball champion of the city of Chicago, 3 years running, before his hands got that big. The cartilage of the ears and the nose continued to grow, and I don't actually know why. But I've noticed that as I've needed to hear better as I get older, my ears are getting larger, and this is good. The nose I don't need. I smell just fine, thank you. Yes?
Is it possible to detect cleft palate,
before they
before?
Yes. The question is whether you can detect some abnormalities before birth, and you can do that in a very fine ultrasound, just in the same way that you can detect that there are genitalia there or not, penis or not. You can detect anything that's large enough to be detected, and the best ultrasound techniques are pretty high resolution. So you can count the fingers and toes, you can see whether the ears have formed, you can see whether the palate is formed. It's just a matter of getting the right angle and being able to stay with it long enough to get a good high resolution photo. Leonard Nilsson, whose photos you saw in the video and in the text, used different techniques. He actually put a fiber optic, an optic fiber into the uterus and took motion pictures of embryos and fetuses. But that's a different process. Normally we would not do that because it's invasive. You have to get actually into the amnion, and then you have all the risks of puncturing the, well, you do puncture, you have to puncture to get in there, and then you have all the risk of miscarriage.
If you do find something, is there any way to stimulate growth in the
child? To stimulate growth? I don't know. That's an interesting question. I think probably not for the palate, because they're forming so early that you probably would not be able to detect them until after they'd happened. You would know when you could get a good image at 4 or 5 months, but you probably wouldn't know when it was happening, which would be when you would need to stimulate growth, if you could do that, and I'm not sure you could do that.
There are
children that are born with incredibly,
like, undersized lungs.
Yes, undersized lungs. It's bizarre.
I want to know how they die in between being born and becoming.
This really bizarre process is it takes advantage of the fact that the lungs grow in response to the pressure of being filled by fluid, some of which is created by the fetus, and some of which is amniotic fluid that has been swallowed or breathed in. Breathed in during the prenatal period. I don't know why tying the trachea, reducing its size, essentially constricting it, causes increased growth in the lung, which is filled with fluid. I have no idea why that works. It probably has a simple answer, but I don't know. But when the child is born, it's important to remove that tie immediately and in the meantime administer oxygen to the newborn and get that working as quickly as possible. But you have to untie immediately. I mean, it's not, you know, tomorrow we can do this. It's now in order to drain the fluid from the lungs so that the newborn can begin taking in air, which it now needs because it's not connected to mom's supply chain, getting air through her lungs. Okay? Couple of other things. We got to get this kid born pretty quickly here. A couple of other things to point out. By 2 months, 9 weeks here, we have the eyes closed. Actually, what that means is that the eyelids have formed. And spontaneous movement. That means that you will begin to see this fetus. It just became a fetus. You'll see the fetus begin to move on its own. What that means is that the musculature is well enough established and connected to the skeletal system and ideally to the central nervous system to allow this marvelous little machine that's being created to function. And one of the ways it functions is to move. And the movements that happen then increase more and more of the body becomes mobile until you get up toward the end of pregnancy when there's a little less movement but more refined movement. So you see hiccups happening, you see kids kicking, and in the video Juan Jose, what was his name? Anyway, the father commented on the fetus moving its, he hoped, its hand around to touch his mouth. It was probably a foot that came around. But you see all kinds of movement, and what that means is that the musculature and skeletal muscular system are functioning. A little later, you'll see all the reflexes being present, and that means that everything is connected from the brain through the nervous system into the muscles and the skeletal system so that when you stimulate a part of the body, the appropriate reflex will occur. A reflex is the action that the body does using the ready-made equipment in response to stimulation of a particular sort. And there are many different reflexes and they serve different purposes, but they're important indicators that the machine is put together in the proper way, that everything is connected. At 10 weeks, the intestine is now in the abdomen. That raises a question. Where was it before? If it's now in the abdomen, and that takes us back to the palate, because it illustrates the same principle of growing a tube by enclosing whatever was there in different tissue. And in the case of the abdomen, you don't have one. What you have is parts forming along the underside of this embryo. And so you've got your gastrointestinal tube, esophagus, your stomach, your intestines, large intestine. Those are all happening, but they're hanging out there in space or in fluid. And what has to happen is that you have to grow an abdomen from the side around to the middle. And as it's doing that, it is creating a space, an internal space, the abdominal cavity, in which you will have all of your internal organs. Assuming that they were in there and didn't get left out when the abdomen grew. So what happens occasionally is that as the abdomen grows around, how can I do this? Top view. Okay, we've got stomach and other stuff. I'm looking down from the top. The abdomen is growing in ideally symmetrically from the sides, and you've got this intestine, and sometimes it's kind of, I mean, it grows pretty randomly as tissue, and sometimes you build an abdomen from the outside, and you can have, in the worst case scenario, you can have your entire GI tract to the large colon out there and nothing inside. Your liver can be out there, your spleen, all that stuff. You don't want it out there, so the competent fetus kind of pushes everything in. No, fetus doesn't do that. But if the child is born with the abdomen not fully surrounding the organs, then you do surgery and put the organs back in because you don't want to have your intestine out there. But it's that same principle of growing from the side symmetrically to create a space, and in this case, the space has the internal organs in it. Think about the umbilical cord, which is out there, connected to the liver and the placenta. It's connecting the liver and the heart to the placenta, and it's going to grow around, the abdomen is going to grow around that, the umbilical cord, and it can't be inside because you can't put the placenta in there, so the embryo has to have something sticking out through the abdomen, and that's your umbilical cord. And when you don't need that anymore because you're born, then the umbilical cord is bitten off, or you know, you use a sharp shell or something to cut it off, or a scalpel if you're modern medicine, and then you clamp it, and then it withers, and then you're left with an abdomen that grew around it, and then but there's no umbilical cord there. But you still have a belly button. That's why you have a belly button. Anyway, you not have a belly button? Be aware that some androids don't have belly buttons. They're really well-designed ones. I actually had a friend in high school who later in life did not have a belly button. He did when he was younger, I can attest to that, but in his early 30s, he managed to ride a motorcycle off the highway into trees and things and was not killed. And they put him back together very nicely, but he had messed up his abdomen and they just simply left it out. They couldn't get it, so it was gone. And he didn't have a belly button then. And they gave him the choice of plastic surgery. And he said, no, it's kind of fun not having a belly button. What happens to your belly button, we will discuss in about 3 minutes. Okay. Is what? It is a form of hernia. Yeah. Okay, anything on there that... We got vocal cords, all those things. Vocabulary stuff. At 18 weeks, the vernix caseosa, that means a cheesy, waxy substance. And that's the stuff that the skin produces prenatally. As your skin is formed, it produces vernix caseosa, which is a waxy stuff made from fat that your mother ate. And it coats the skin for the same purpose that a person swimming the English Channel needs to put on lots of gunk, petroleum, to protect the skin. Because if you're in the water for a long period of time, your skin becomes very fragile. For a fetus, the skin is already very, very fragile. It's only a layer at first, and then two layers, and then three layers of cells. But even at birth, its skin is still fragile. And if you didn't secrete that vernix caseosa, then you would do damage to your skin by being in the amniotic fluid, and by moving around, you can actually rub the skin off. Ossification is the creation of bone. And the important, at 12 weeks, it says ossification in the palms, soles, fingers, and toes. Before that, the word is not used, but at 46 to 48 days, ossification actually begins, where it says first bone cells in the upper arms. And that is one of the definitions for the transition from embryo to fetus. The embryo means that things are still originating or forming. Fetus means that you're past that stage and you're now a developing, about to be born in a few months, person. The beginning of the bone cells in the upper arm is considered to be the beginning of the skeleton. That's kind of an arbitrary definition. Do you all understand the embryo is developing a skeleton, but it's made of cartilage? Cartilage is the precursor to bone. Sharks have cartilaginous skeletons and no bone. They're very primitive that way. We start off with a cartilaginous skeleton. It's just cartilage. It's a different substance. But that cartilage forms the matrix around which bone cells are created when they start getting created. And eventually you'll have, you'll be a bonehead. You'll have arms and legs, and all of those things will be completely made of bone. But that process isn't going to be complete until way in the future. I am unaware. The question is, can the cartilage in the bone, in the nose or ear, turn into bone? I don't know why it couldn't, but I'm not familiar with a condition like that. You do have bone in your nose, but the end part, the part that pops and crackles for many of us, is just cartilage. And then the side part is cartilage. Okay, and the last vocabulary word I wanted to add was lanugo. Some people at 20 weeks, some people aren't familiar with that. That's hair. And the lanugo is a throwback to our evolutionary history. In the fifth month, all of your skin cells, not all of your skin cells, but your hair follicles, which are all over your body, create hair. And they start to function during that period of time. And so the fetus at that point has hair typically on its back and shoulders and chest, sometimes the lower part of the face. All of those places where you're going to be able to grow hair later in your 60s or 50s as a man, and you're going to kind of wish sometimes it wasn't there. If you have a very hairy back, have a grandson jump on you in the swimming pool when your back is wet and slide down. Waxing. It's just like waxing, they tell me. L-A-N-U-G-O. It's on the handout there. Okay? And typically that hair drops off, although some kids are born. Prematures often have lanugo. It's very fine and it's very fragile, so it just in wiping a child off, you'll wipe most of it off. But some kids have a fair amount of it, and that is, for some of them, a pretty good predictor that they're going to have thick and healthy hair later, because the hair follicles are working so well. You'll notice in the text that there's some research on movement that is cited. Research by Janet DiPietro. And it talks about fetal movement and the fact that it begins to decline. If you just measure how much the fetus moves, it begins to decline. And that's in part because there's more nervous control, but also in part because the size of the fetus is getting closer to the maximum and there's not as much room to move. What the authors of the text don't point out is that there's a significant sex difference between boy and girl fetuses. Both decline in the number of movements, but the difference is that the girls decline much more than the boys do. And from that point, when that decline begins, the two sexes become different through the last 3 months, probably 4 months of pregnancy. Boys move much more often, and their movements are much bigger. They're stronger movements. That difference in activity level has almost no overlap. So boy babies are really, boy fetuses are much more active than girl fetuses. There's a little bit of overlap. You have some hyperactive girls and some quiet boys, but not that many. And that difference in activity level continues. And it gets bigger through childhood and adolescence. The girls get less and less active compared to boys, and boys get more and more active, and the difference is very large, and continues as a tendency to move more and to be more frustrated when movement is inhibited, more distressed by inhibition of movement throughout life. So when we talk about boys needing more activity, that begins during the fetal period. So it's not something that parents influence or we could just teach them to sit still. The bodies are actually different and they need more physical activity. Okay. Then the fetus, the uterus gets full of fetus, decides, I've had this, I don't want this anymore, I'm tired of this. If it's July, it gets really hot and you don't want this baby anymore, and you start to experience some changes. And one of the changes is that the uterus starts to practice contractions. And so you start early on having waves of contraction, just like tightening your muscles. And those are called Braxton Hicks contractions, after two people who didn't invent them but identified them and named them. And women experience this. First-time mothers often get a little upset by this because they think they're going into labor, but they're not productive. It's just a wave of contraction through the uterus, but it's not productive. But it is important in getting the movements coordinated so that when you do begin productive labor, the uterus is ready to go and has figured out how to do this, because you don't want to start those contractions at the bottom and try to squeeze the baby up. No. They need to start at the top of the uterus and squeeze down. You can have an argument about the toothpaste tube at home, whether you squeeze it in the middle or the end. No, but there's no argument with the uterus. It needs to have the contraction start at the top and squeeze the baby down and out.
How long before birth do
you
start counting?
6 weeks before birth, often, sometimes a month, but usually 4 to 6 weeks you'll have practice contractions happening. And sometimes they're very strong. And then we get to real labor. The amniotic fluid has been discharged. You're out there, you're squeezing down on this fetus, trying to get it out through this opening that is much too small for it. And the baby becomes very stressed. And its brain begins to secrete substances, hormones, stress hormones, that say, you're stressing me, I don't do this anymore. And it's doing that because as you squeeze down on this baby, the head is trying to go through this pelvic opening, which is made of bone, hips, And the head is made of bone, and it is bigger than the pelvic opening. And you can't get there from here unless you do the wonderful magic trick. How many of you have vegetable steamers at home? Those metal collapsible things that expand to fit a bit by having different plates that slide against each other. And so it expands or contracts depending on the size of the pot. That's what the skull does. The skull is made of several plates. And as you squeeze it, it needs to go through an opening that's too small. So the plates overlap. Just like that vegetable steamer, except they're a little irregular. And as they overlap, they are squeezing the brain. They are causing it to secrete stress hormones. And the skull is getting smaller. And it can do that because the plates are not fused yet. They're separate bones. They will fuse later. And there's a hole in the middle, which allows you the room to overlap. And that hole in the middle is called the fontanelle. And it's covered with a thick membrane. And over the first few months after delivery, the bones are going to grow to cover that so you can stop worrying about Big Brother poking the baby's brain through the fontanelle. That set of hormones that the fetus is secreting are increasing its blood flow, its metabolism, its heart rate. It's making it alert. And it's getting it ready for birth because it needs to be pumped. It needs to be psyched and ready to go. Chariots of fire, music, that's what the hormones are for. Let's get out of here. Let's breathe. Let's take over that breathing. We really need to do that. Let's eat. Let's find out what the world is about. And all those stress hormones are important for doing that. And if you have a cesarean section without contraction, you don't have that. So cesarean section babies are calmer. They're actually less alert. They look prettier because their heads have not been shaped like footballs by the contractions. Which is normal newborns look like footballs. And you can carry them that way. It works quite well. And question?
Is it bad to be born butt first?
It's bad to be born butt first because you can't be born butt first. That's called a breech. You presented butt first. But if they delivered you butt first, they broke your hips. It's called a breech presentation. This is the breech of the body. And anything that is not a head presentation is potentially dangerous. Think about trying to get your butt through there first with your legs folded up against your abdomen. You can do it, but it isn't good for you. No, the question is whether the contractions would hurt your brain. You're actually folded up in there. And the contractions and the squeezing of the skull are not going to hurt your brain. The contraction, the shrinking of the skull by the overlapping is a process that happens because you need to go through the pelvic opening. The contractions aren't going to do that to you. It's the pressure of the pelvic opening that is actually forming, making that skull deform that way. Anytime you do a breech delivery, you're risking neurological damage, nervous system damage. Think about coming out hands first. Now you're going to try to get the head and the arms out. You can't do that. So if a kid presents with the hands first, you push them back in. Legs first, feet first, you can do, but it's difficult. And you have to go in around and get the arms down and get them out so that the head can come out. And your problem is that when you're trying to get the head through there, you may be acting as if you're trying to pull the head off and stretch the spinal cord, which can lead to various degrees of paralysis. You don't want a non-standard delivery, which is why people spend a lot of time pushing, massaging, standing on their head, jumping off tables, trying to get the baby to come down head first, because that's the way it wants to be delivered. In multiple gestations, as two or more fetuses at the same time, the same things are going to happen, but delivery is likely to be premature, and it will be complicated because you have two fetuses both trying to get squoze out at the same time. And that doesn't work. You can't get two out. So multiple gestations, two or more fetuses, are much more likely to be C-section now. You can get them to line up, and you can get one down, but the problem is that you have an umbilical cord attached to the one who's still inside. It may get hung up on the first one and get yanked, so there's no placental connection. It's a problem. Right. You can have the umbilical cords wrapped around each other, around the kids, and that can lead to excessive bleeding or problems for the fetus because it needs oxygen, and if the placenta separates, it's not going to get it. So when there are those kinds of problems, you check with ultrasound before delivery, and then you try to sort things out. And we're going to... told you we'd get the kid born today. Just believe it. We're going to hand out a half sheet of paper. Just scatter them up through there. Pass them up as quickly as you can. Put your name on it. And I'll put a question up on the screen, and the task is to write the most detailed answer you can in the next 5 minutes. Yes, you may use your notes. Simple question. Okay. I promised you writing exercises for a small number of points occasionally. This is one of those. Reward for being here. And also some feedback to us about what you're understanding about that question. And when you're done, if you'll just bring your paper down to the front and drop it on the table, we will pick it up. And Tal, you will read them. I may read them too.